is Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome back to another week of two girls in New England talking about the thing they love, true crime.
Yes. And today is a very special episode, I think. I know that I'm very honored to be able to talk about this. Really amazing.
I think one of the most beautiful things about this community is literally that, the community. You find people who have stories to tell, and if you are able to tell them, it's the best feeling because all you want to do is help. We want to find answers. We want to get the word out there.
Incredible. So
when we realized that we had the capacity to share a story of a woman in Rhode Island, we absolutely wanted to jump on that.
That was incredible. So a couple weeks ago, our True Crime New England Instagram account was tagged in a post. A couple other Rhode Island-based Instagram accounts were tagged, maybe a couple other true crime accounts.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh my God, someone tagged us in a photo.
Yeah.
Let me see what this is about.
Yeah.
So it's this woman's daughter who is advocating for her mom who died under very suspicious circumstances.
Yeah.
And she is doing an incredible job advocating for not only her mom, but for other people who need justice and need their cases solved out of Rhode Island as well.
Absolutely. She's doing so much work.
It's incredible.
It's amazing. You guys can follow her for all of this incredible info, these cases that aren't as heard of as other cases, you know, what we talk about literally every week. She has an Instagram account called Unsolved RI for Rhode Island, of course, and that's also the title of her blog online. She does amazing work. She is such an advocate for these crimes that just don't get a lot of attention, especially being that her mom is one of those victims.
And it's, you know, it's still in the works. My understanding is, you know, she's working on launching it and getting it off the ground, but the information that she has so far and the work that she's already done is phenomenal.
So thorough.
So when, you know, we were tagged in this post for this woman's mom, of course we had to take this case on.
Absolutely. So naturally you messaged her and you said, hey, we just want to make sure it's all right. Can we cover your case? And she said, yes, of course.
Yes, please.
You know, no podcast too small, you know? And so we have been so humbled and so honored to be speaking with her about this suspicious death of her mother. You know, it's just, we got so much information from her. She was very, very helpful.
This website, you guys, I highly recommend you check it out. UnsolvedRI.com. There are police reports, autopsy reports, photos of her mother's planner. The amount of time and research and effort that this woman has put in, it's really incredible.
Yes.
And it has made covering this case a lot easier, honestly.
Yes. She has so much
It's incredible.
Stuff. She's been digging deep and doing a fantastic job.
Yeah.
So we're really honored to be able to do this case hopefully tell her story in a way that maybe somebody knows something.
Yeah.
Maybe more awareness is all it needs. And I think that's really important, and we're so excited.
For sure.
So ready to tell this story. So without further ado, we will be covering the case of
the suspicious death of Lori Malloy.
Okay, per usual, let's get into it with our sources. Katie?
Yeah, I had abc6.com, change.org. There's a petition. We will talk about that at the end, so stay tuned. And then, of course, unsolvedri.com. That was a phenomenal resource. We could not have told this case without all of the resources that Lori Malloy's daughter provided to us.
She did a fantastic job. And I had my resources from that as well.
Yeah.
I also used Lauren's blog. Lauren is Lori's daughter.
Yes.
The creator of Unsolved RI, and she has a fantastic blog full of a whole bunch of stuff. Absolutely not just this case, but a whole bunch of fun stuff she does, and like food and all that. It's called Life by Lauren Lee, and she has, you know, this whole section about Unsolved RI and about her mother's case, and my God, it's thorough. She walks you right through it. She does a fantastic job.
She was amazing. And I also used Lauren herself as a resource as well. Yeah. She took the time out of her day to answer some questions that we had, which was so amazing.
Nice. She sent us some really thorough details. She was did not hold back.
No, and she's a badass for doing this, not only for just her mom, but for other cases as well.
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
So let's start on March 7th, 1993. It's roughly 1 PM, and a man named Henry Costa walks into the East Providence Police Department. He was concerned about his girlfriend, Lori Lee Malloy. He had not heard from her since March 1st, which was 6 days prior, so he was a little nervous, and this wasn't really like Lori to not contact him.
Right.
So he, you know, he walks into the police station, he says, "Hey, I'm nervous about my girlfriend, can we do, like, a welfare check?" And they're like, "Yeah." The only thing is, he doesn't know where her, like, the physical address of her house is.
Mm-hmm.
He just knows where it is. Like, he could take someone there. So, eventually, he meets with a investigative officer, Anthony Brito, and they meet on Hall Street, which is where Lori's apartment is located. So, they decide, okay, great, let's go in together. You show me where to go. So Officer Brito rang the doorbell to Lori's apartment and got no answer. So they went downstairs to the landlord's relative and who lived downstairs. His name was Pasquale, or he went by Pat, and he lived with his wife, Christine. And they were like, "Oh yeah, why don't you go like knock on her doors? I'm going to call my sister and she's going to get the spare keys for you."
Mm-hmm.
So they go, they're like, "Okay, sweet." So they go upstairs and they go to knock on the door when Officer Brito realizes the door's cracked open.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, "That's weird." And in the background, he can hear running water. So he calls out, "Hello? Hello?" There's no answer. And he tries it again. Maybe she can't hear him over the faucet running.
Right.
So he tries again, "Hello? Hello?" And when there's no answer, this is when he enters the apartment.
The scene that he found, he did find 30-year-old Lori Lee Malloy. Her nickname was Sled Dog. He found her deceased in her bathroom. She was naked.
Mm-hmm.
She was covered in bruises, and she had chunks, not just pieces, chunks of her hair missing. Her hair was actually found all over the apartment.
Yeah, it was very bizarre.
There was a clump of her hair in between the toes of her left foot. There was a clump wrapped between the fingers of her right hand, and there was another clump around her left wrist where it looked almost like a bracelet.
Yeah.
And then around her body, there were slices of bread.
This was the most bizarre part to me, because yes, it's very bizarre to have so many like clumps of hair around the apartment. Like, what happened? But she's laying naked in her bathroom, and there's just a ton of pieces of bread.
Right, and the faucet's running full blast.
Yeah.
Like, I don't...
What is happening here?
Police also found 2 drinking glasses. There was some kind of leftover food salad in a tub up on the table. And I thought this was a very bizarre detail. The refrigerator was full of food, but someone had unplugged it.
Yeah, that's super peculiar.
Yeah.
Like, what is the reasoning behind that? Nothing I could even pretend to think of would make sense for that.
Right.
It's very bizarre.
And for her to have clumps of hair on her person, especially between the fingers of her right hand, as if she had pulled it out herself.
Right.
But then it would have gone, you know, there's clumps of hair in between the toes of her left foot and then around her wrist, like a bracelet almost.
Very weird.
It's very strange. So immediately the scene was classified as a homicide.
Right.
Immediately.
Yeah. She was naked. She had all this hair around her, the glasses, there was 2 of them, there was, you know, bruising on her body. Very bizarre. So they were like, okay, this is not... There was no outward reason why they would believe that she was murdered, like, right off, besides maybe the bruising on her legs, and, like, the weird clumps of hair. But other than that, it was just very suspicious. It didn't feel right. And what sucks the most is that Henry, as he was with Officer Brito, he saw the scene. He remarked, you know, he goes, "Oh my God." And Brito's like, "Get out, go stand outside." He calls for backup. He actually calls rescue, and they come in and they're immediately like, "There's nothing for us to do here."
Right.
So they leave. And now, you know, investigative officers are coming in and they begin to look around and they look for, you know, evidence of any kind. And they just find a whole bunch of hair.
Yeah.
And not only did they find the hair in her, both her hands around her wrists and in her feet, like on her foot, they also found a large clump of light brown hair in a sneaker on the side table next to her doorway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's bizarre. And what's even weirder is that there's a baby sock, because Lori was the mother of an 18-month-old infant.
Mm-hmm.
And in the baby sock was light brown hair, like clumps of light brown hair. So not only is it on her persons, but it's around the apartment in a shoe, in a baby sock?
Right. But what was really strange about this particular clump of hair is that it was different from Lori's.
Right.
It was more light brown in color. The officer that saw it described it as if it had been ripped out of someone's head.
Ooh.
Yeah. So this evidence that they took, they ended up taking 14 total pieces of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So most of those pieces of evidence were different clumps of hair from around various areas of the apartment, different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
They also took a pink bath towel that looked like it had mucus on it.
Yeah.
The light brown clump of hair that was in the men's shoe with the baby sock. They took bed sheets and the comforter from the master bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
They also took several items of infant clothing from Lori's daughter, Lauren, which included a yellow sweater and then the baby sock.
Right.
Other hair samples, Lori's address book, and then the two drinking glasses that were on the table.
Right. Maybe they could get DNA from those glasses. Like,
right.
Why would she have two? You know? Weird.
Clearly someone was here.
Yeah. And of note on her body, she had a bruise, apparently recent, on her upper right arm, and a few also semi-recent bruises on her upper thighs.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, besides the obvious result of death, from the pressure of laying on the bathroom floor and dying, you know, there was some marks from the ceramic tile, but other than that, there was no physical injuries apparent.
Right.
So it was just very, okay, what happened here?
They ended up doing a sexual assault kit on Lori's body, but they were not able to find anything remarkable.
Yeah.
So that's something very important to note as well.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Lori Malloy a little bit. We got some of this information from her daughter, you know, a little insight on who her mom was. She was a head cheerleader in high school. She loved to cheer, and it seemed like she absolutely loved animals.
Yeah.
According to Lauren, she never met a dog that did not like her and that she did not like, which is like, that's my kind of people.
Right,
love
for sure.
That. She was just such an animal person, and she loved traveling, most notably on her motorcycle. So she was kind of a badass.
Oh, for sure.
Yes. She was super smart. She got all A's in high school. Just an overall, just accomplished, good person.
Right. You look at the photos of her, they're going to be on our website and our Instagram, you guys. There's one photo of her holding baby Lauren. It is a sweet photo. She looks like a lovely lady.
Yeah, and there's this one picture of her just, like, chilling in, like, this oversized sweater. She is so beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. She's just a young woman.
Right.
Yeah, she's gorgeous.
30 years old.
Yeah. And so she had a sister, Allison, and her mother, Alice, who do come up in this story.
Mm-hmm.
In 1988, Lori got married to this man named John Mariano. He also went by, for some reason, Scary Harry. And they were married on Valentine's Day in 1988 at Lori's dad's house in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Scary Harry, although his name would make you think he's a really stand-up guy, he had a bit of a criminal record.
Yeah.
Just a bit. Unfortunately, just 8 months after their wedding, so around October of 1988, John was in jail for felony domestic violence against Lori, unfortunately.
Yeah. He had written her a letter, actually. In this letter, John told Lori that she could testify against him and see him in 2 years, or she could ask the state of Rhode Island to drop charges. And he wrote, this is a quote, "If you show up and bitch against me, I'll probably be looking at about 1 to 2 years, which means I'll be getting out in about 18 months. It's your choice. See me in about a month or 2 years."
Wow, what a great ultimatum.
He then committed felony assault against Lori in 1990, about when he got out from his first prison sentence around that time.
Yeah.
He violated a protective order against her just before she filed for divorce. Mm-hmm. She was able to file in April of 1990, but her divorce was not granted until December of 1992.
Which is so fucking long.
And a really sad detail is that her divorce was finalized 3 weeks after her death.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now, while John, her estranged husband, was in lockup, she began seeing a man named Thomas Kelly. Mm-hmm. And even though she was technically married to John, I wouldn't really say it was an affair. Like, he was in jail, he was a criminal, he abused her.
Right, he beat the shit out of her, and now he's in prison for it.
Yeah. So
she's allowed to move on.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So she started seeing Thomas Kelly, and Thomas Kelly was actually a career criminal, and, you know, it just seemed like the same kind of pattern as with John. The only really good thing she got from Thomas Kelly was her beautiful daughter, Lauren.
Mm-hmm. On July 27th, 1992, Lori ended up breaking things off with Thomas Kelly, who was the father of Lauren. Mm-hmm. And then on August 8th, 1992, she wrote in her planner, this is a quote, "Tommy's threats over Lauren will settle soon." And then Lauren was eventually removed from Tommy's care after her mother's death when she was about 18 months old.
Ah, gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, she had just, it seemed like she just kept getting in the wrong place, in the wrong situation with these crummy guys, and I get it.
And once you're in a cycle, we've talked about it before, it is so difficult to get out of it.
Yes, absolutely.
And oftentimes we will see, and it starts off when children are young, mm-hmm. there's a cycle or a pattern, and then they end up staying with that into their adulthood, and then it follows them into their adulthood. And cycles are not easy to break.
Not at all. No. So it didn't help that Lori had a diagnosis of depression with schizophrenic-like features because that just makes it harder to get out of these kind of situations. It just makes it harder and makes the victim go through a much more vulnerable, difficult time. So she did have those problems that she was dealing with through East Bay Mental Health, and she was on prescription medication for it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Lori was also addicted to cocaine and other substances at the time of her death. Likely pills and supposedly marijuana, but as we know nowadays, marijuana isn't exactly a problem, so we'll kind of take that out of the list.
Yeah, it's not addictive.
Yeah. 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 So, according to her boyfriend at the time of her death, you might remember at the beginning of the story, Henry Costa, she had been doing cocaine a few times a week after having her baby. Mm-hmm. So she was kind of going on the downward spiral.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate. And that kind of leads us, let's go into the timeline of when, leading up to when she was found dead.
For sure. We'll put some pieces together for you guys.
Absolutely. Let's start with February 26th, 1993. Lori called her mother, Alice, and asked if she could come pick her up, as well as her daughter, Lauren, and bring her to her sister Allison's house.
Mm-hmm.
Lori was sick, she was feeling sick, and she was overwhelmed, and taking care of a baby on your own when you're sick is hard. So she was like, can you just help me? Can you watch her for a little bit so I can have a break and rest and heal up?
Right.
And they were like, yeah. I'm sure they were like, time with my niece, with my granddaughter? Absolutely.
Right, bring her over. Yeah. She's so cute. Bring her over.
Yeah, right. So that was February 26th. And on March 1st, which was a Monday, Lori stopped by Allison's house with her mom. And she brought more clothes for Lauren.
Yes.
And Lori stated that she still felt like shit and that she had seen a doctor a few days prior ago and that supposedly she had been diagnosed with some kind of flu. But that was all Allison, who was reporting this information, knew.
Yeah.
She didn't really know much of anything, just that Lori was sick and she looked like she was sick and, you know, she had gotten, you know, prescriptions for it. She had the flu. And it's hard to take care of a baby when you have the flu.
For sure. And she was fully sick, so she wrote in her planner. She actually went to the doctor on February 23rd, 1993. She was prescribed antibiotics, specifically erythromycin. And her daughter, Lauren, was actually prescribed nystatin cream for a rash because Lauren was also sick, kind of not feeling well. Lauren got over it pretty quickly. She wrote in her planner, actually, that she had been feeling sick since the 18th of February, 1993. She also wrote that a couple days later, Lauren got sick and developed, quote, red patches. So that was what the nystatin cream was for.
Mm-hmm.
but, you know, the baby got over it pretty quickly.
That's good.
Lori still feels like crap.
Yeah.
So she started getting sick on the 18th of February, and she's still ill the 1st of March.
That's a long time. Poor thing.
That's a really long time.
That sucks. And taking care of a baby by yourself.
Oh my God, I know.
And a baby who also is sick for some of that time. God, that's awful. Jesus. Poor thing. Now, March 2nd, Allison claims that she called Lori several times before she finally picked up the phone at around, like, 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And Lori said she was so tired and she had been sleeping all day, which is totally typical of the flu.
For sure.
Because her whole body is, like, exhausted.
You feel like you got hit by a truck.
Absolutely. So she was sleeping all day, and on this phone call, Lori asked Allison if Allison could come back to pick her up for her welfare check so she could cash it, and then they could go back to the doctor's and she could, you know, see the doctor again, because she still felt like crap. So it was like, okay, that's March 2nd.
Right.
That's a Tuesday. On Wednesday morning, around 9 to 10 a.m., Allison stopped by Lori's apartment like they, you know, had previously agreed upon, and she knocked and rang the doorbell. There was no answer. You know, she checked in Lori's mailbox. There was no check inside, which supposedly there should have been if she was going to get her welfare check. Allison then went home and kept calling Lori's house because, you know, there was no cell phones back then. And she just kept getting no response. So now it's, you know, Wednesday the 3rd, there's no response. She goes over to pick up her sister like they talked about. No answer. That's not good.
No.
Yeah. So around 7 p.m. on March 3rd, that same day, Allison called Henry Costa, her boyfriend, Lori's boyfriend, and asked if he had heard from her. And he said he had last heard from her, like, the night before or Monday night. You know, it had been a few, like, a day or two.
Yeah, yeah.
No big deal. And so Allison was like, all right, you know, she's sick. She didn't answer my phone for a long time yesterday. She was sleeping, whatever. But, I mean, it's causing a little bit of worry. A little bit of worry. So between the 3rd and the 6th, which the 6th is a Saturday, Allison kept calling Lori's house over and over, but nobody answered. And that was when it kind of started to get really just scary.
Yeah.
You know, where was her sister? Why was she not picking her phone up? You know, she hadn't asked about her daughter. She hadn't come for her daughter. It was just very bizarre.
Right. And she also hadn't cashed the welfare check, or so it seemed, because she needed her sister's help with that.
Right.
So it's like, how is she, you know, getting money and supporting herself and mm-hmm. feeding herself? And, you know, it's just, it's starting to get a little scary.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Henry Costa, like we said at the beginning, he says that the last time he saw Lori was on March 1st of 1993. Mm-hmm. He had apparently met Lori at her apartment to give her cigarettes. She had called him and asked him to bring them to her. They were actually in a fight at that time, so he didn't say much more. He just dropped them off for her and left.
Right.
On March 6th, though, that Saturday, Henry went to see Allison and asked if she had heard from Lori, because he hadn't.
Right.
She hadn't either. So they were like, okay.
They're starting to get a little concerned.
Yeah.
And Allison, in a police statement she gave, said that sometimes before Lori had her baby, mm-hmm. she would go a couple days, you know, not talking to anybody, kind of doing her own thing. Mm-hmm. But it really was only for a few days, not like this. And then once she had her baby, Lauren, that behavior stopped.
Yeah.
So Lauren is about 18 months old at this time. So they had not seen this behavior out of Lori for at least 18 months.
Right, right.
So now this is... Right, exactly. It's been a while. So now this is cause for concern.
Absolutely. That's really scary.
Yeah.
And so that Saturday, the 6th, Henry decided to stop by Lori's house. And, you know, within an hour, he was back at Allison's place telling her that she didn't answer the door. And so the thing was, Allison wasn't home at that time. So instead, Henry told Allison's boyfriend, Richard Duarte, he had answered the door and took the message for her. And now that brings us to Sunday, March 7th, when Henry went back to Allison's house to ask if she had learned anything new. This was in the morning. Allison said no, and now they were really worried. Mm-hmm. So this is when Henry goes to the police station, and they go for a welfare check, and they find Lori's body dead on the bathroom floor.
Yeah. There was also a police statement given by a woman named Rebecca Lascarbo. She told police she spoke to Lori on the phone maybe a week before her death about there.
Okay.
Rebecca said that Lori sounded kind of groggy and, you know, was giggling and told Rebecca she had taken some pills.
Hmm.
Rebecca initially brushed it off because she'd known Lori for years.
Mm-hmm.
She knew Lori to have kind of a tolerance for drugs at times, so she wasn't too concerned. You know, this wasn't out of the blue.
Yeah.
This wasn't her first time with drugs.
Right.
So Rebecca's not too concerned.
Right.
She grew concerned when on the day of Lori's death, she got a call from Henry.
Right.
Henry expressed to her that he was very concerned over having not heard from Lori, and he also mentioned they got into an argument a few days prior over cocaine. Henry alleges that he told Lori to stop using cocaine, and she said, "You're not going to tell me what to do, I'll do what I want,"
mm-hmm.
you know, one of those. So he was kind of giving her the silent treatment, you know, if you're not going to change your behavior and you're not going to stop with cocaine, I'm not going to talk to you.
Right.
I'll just drop off your cigarettes like you asked me to and then call it a day.
Yep.
He ended up dropping them off on the porch. Like, he didn't even hand them to her.
Yeah.
He dropped them off.
Yeah, they were in a pretty serious fight.
Yeah. So Rebecca actually called the police after Henry got off the phone with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she felt like something wasn't right. And then she ended up calling them back for an update that afternoon. And that's when she was asked to come down to the station to give a statement.
Yeah.
So she knew something really is wrong. And that's how she found out that Lori had passed away.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And so, it's crazy because now Henry is like, he's talking about, you know, with the cops that, yes, Lori did have a drug problem.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that last time he saw her, they were fighting. So this argument that Henry had had with Lori, you know, the last time he had seen her about her cocaine abuse, it kind of led to him bringing up another name in their investigation.
Uh-huh.
A man named Darren Roderick. He was basically, as far as we know, Lori's cocaine dealer. And Henry claimed that at least 6 times he had been at Lori's apartment and seen Darren bring her the cocaine. So he was kind of like, you know, brought up to their attention. Henry said that he would usually bring her anywhere from a $20 to $60 bag of cocaine, you know, depending on how much money she had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Henry actually was initially considered a suspect in this, but then he was cleared after investigation. Darren, the dealer, was interviewed about this case, and he gave a statement where he said, "I wouldn't be surprised if he," meaning Henry, was the whole thing behind it. He also mentioned that the cops never came to him even after his name was brought up to them, and Henry was the one that brought up his name. So it really is just an unfortunate situation, because it's like, this woman's family needs answers.
Her little baby.
Knows that, right, her child, 18 months old, is going to grow up without a mother. And it's just, the circumstances around it are very infuriating, and we will get into why.
I was just about to say, let's talk about the autopsy.
I can't
It's deal insane. With this. So, March 8th, the day after they found Lori's body, an autopsy was performed by Dr. F. John Krolikowski. Now, this guy...
You can't make this shit up.
He's, So you and I, Katie, we read the full autopsy report.
Yes.
Very interesting, in the fact that it wasn't interesting at all. Everything seemed to be unremarkable.
Right.
In an autopsy, you know, there's a lot of the medical language used, and a lot of the language can be kind of hard to understand. I think you and I have a foot up in that sense, that we know we can understand it a little better. So in an autopsy, though, when they don't find anything, instead of wasting their time and saying we didn't find anything, they'll say the organs of the digestive system were unremarkable, or the reproductive system organs were unremarkable.
Right.
So in this autopsy, like, every other word was unremarkable. This guy found nothing. Yeah. So basically what he had said, you know, he described who he was autopsying. So, he, you know, this woman he described, Lori, in that her face was slightly bloated and filled with blood, and that was caused by laying on the bathroom floor.
Yeah.
He described that she had, you know, ceramic tile indents on her left side. And then this was so interesting to me. He says that the weight of her lungs determined that Lori was unconscious on the floor for 2 to 3 hours before she finally died. And she due to his findings, had only been dead for about an hour before she was found. So that brings the question, why was she not answering her phone for 4 days prior to that?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
And that sounds a little bit contradictory to me.
Yeah.
Like, his findings are already contradicting himself.
Yeah. So, you know, he talks about the weird clumps of hair in between her toes mm-hmm. and on her wrist. But he also said she had no external red flags. Yes, she had a few bruises, but she didn't have any cuts. She didn't have any fractures. She didn't have any needle marks.
Right.
He also said her internal exam was unremarkable. The only thing that, you know, caused him just a little question was that she had a moderate degree of left ventricular hypertrophy, which is one of the chambers of her heart was just a little bigger than it should be, which is not fatal for a young, healthy woman.
Right.
So, you know, they did tests and what they do with the organs, they weigh them, they, you know, take tissue samples, and that was all unremarkable mm-hmm. still.
Yeah. So wouldn't it be so fascinating that, you know, everything's unremarkable, this clown of a guy, I can't, like, I don't even want to refer to him as a doctor.
I know.
He ended up closing her case. Because he determined that her cause of death was, quote, natural, and that she died from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which, to break that down, it's where the walls of your heart thicken until they can't really pump blood anymore.
Not efficiently, anyway.
Right. What gets me about this is that this condition, first of all, is extremely rare. Second of all, the average age for diagnosis of this issue is age 39, because that's when it starts causing problems.
Right.
Lori was 30.
Yeah.
Young, healthy, I mean, as healthy as one could be if they are supposedly doing drugs.
Yeah. Very peculiar.
For this heart condition to have caused Lori's death, it would have had to have resulted in sudden death.
Yeah.
So her heart would have had to give out, essentially.
Right. So not that she would have been laying on the floor for 2 hours before she died, unconscious.
Right.
Okay.
And also, if she did have this condition, which this guy is saying that she does, her heart findings would have been more so than unremarkable.
Right.
What gets me is, and I think that a lot of times with people who are said to use and abuse cocaine,
mm-hmm.
cocaine is a stimulant.
Correct.
It's often cut with other things.
Mm-hmm.
At work, sometimes I'll see people who have cocaine addictions.
Right.
And oftentimes it is very detrimental to your heart.
Yes.
So what gets me about this is that they also did a drug screening
yep.
for Lori. Everything's negative.
Yep.
She's clean.
She's totally clean.
So there's no cocaine in her system at this time.
Right.
But, you know, it's written off as, oh, she does a lot of coke, you know, she's a drug user, of course she'd have a heart condition because of this.
And I think it's really important to note that cocaine leaves the body fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, like, at my job, I do have a fair share of moms that come in who are addicted to cocaine and give birth to a baby, and they test positive for cocaine, and the baby tests positive for cocaine, which means mm-hmm. that they would have to do it within a few hours.
Right.
So if we're saying that, you know, maybe she was such a drug addict that she died from a cocaine overdose,
right.
it would have been in her system.
Right,
absolutely.
Or if the cocaine resulted in extra strain on her heart that would have killed her, which is what this guy is basically hinting towards,
yeah.
there would be evidence for that.
Absolutely.
And what kills me is that it's just so infuriating because this guy, so doctor, I use that term loosely, F. John Krolikowski, whatever, he's so bad at his job. He's a pathetic excuse for a human being,
he's
frankly.
Fraudulent as fuck.
Thank you. Yes. He actually lost his license to practice in Rhode Island after already losing it in Massachusetts. He was known for misdiagnosing cases. He had hundreds of cases that had to be reviewed by the Attorney General's office. Lori's case was only missed by just a couple months.
Ugh.
Right under the wire.
Yeah.
He was a temporary fill-in employee at the Rhode Island State Medical Examiner's office.
Ugh.
So if this had happened just a couple months before, a couple months after
right.
this guy came along, I'm fully convinced that she would have gotten a completely different diagnosis.
Absolutely.
And her case would not have been closed. That's what kills me, is not only is this guy incorrectly diagnosing her cause of death.
Right.
It went from being classified as a homicide to a fatal heart condition. Like, there's no way.
A 30-year-old woman.
That's what I'm saying. There's no
way.
Very
bizarre.
When her cardiac findings were unremarkable. Riddle me that.
Yeah. And this guy, he was a piece of shit. I read that a lot of the fraudulent, you know, findings he had made originally had to do with, like, a cancer study, a prostate cancer study. And then it was something like he had diagnosed, or, like, said prostate cancer was the diagnosis and the death of, like, 120 people or something like that. And only 20 of them were actually prostate. Something crazy like that.
Oh, my God.
Like, such a wide difference in the numbers, like, what he said and what was true, that it was like, what the hell? This guy is a joke.
Now imagine the trauma of finding out your loved one has died from mysterious prostate cancer and thinking like, oh my God, my loved one must have hid their cancer diagnosis from me. How could I have missed this? Why did I not notice?
Yeah.
And it's a completely false diagnosis.
Yeah.
He also did not make any note in any of the autopsy reports. There's pages and pages and pages of this. You know, it's available to us. You go to unsolvedri.com. It's right there.
You'll find it.
You can look at it.
It's
Liz and I both look. It's fascinating.
It's interesting in the fact that it's unremarkable.
Right. And also, what's crazy is that he made no note of the condition of her scalp.
Oh, correct. That's a good point.
There's chunks of hair all over her.
Missing.
Wrapped in her toes, wrapped in her fingers, on her wrist like a bracelet. Covering the apartment, like, they described it as chunks of hair, chunks.
Like it had been
everywhere.
Ripped out.
Yes. And they did not say a single word about the condition of her scalp. Hello.
It's ridiculous.
Hello.
And then, of course, you know, he says, oh, it's a natural death. She died of this heart condition. Case closed.
Right. Right. So East Providence Police Department, they were forced to close this case.
Right.
Even though they were like, there were pieces of bread around her naked, bruised body, and there's hair everywhere, but you want to say it's a heart condition?
Yeah, I don't know what he was...
I don't get it. So they had to close this fucking case.
Right! It sounds like he's just rushing through being like, yeah, this, oh, you know what? This was a little... Let's just say it was a heart condition. I got dinner with my mom at 10.
Yes, cause of death, natural, case closed, goodbye.
Even though it was treated as a homicide.
Right.
Yes.
No regard for... the victim, no regard for the victim's family.
No, none at all.
And no regard, honestly, for your job.
Nope.
If this is your job, have some respect.
He's a piece of garbage, truly. And this, I mean, like we said, the sad part is, that's it. That's it.
That's it, period. Her case, they closed her case.
That's it. And so, this is where Lori's daughter, Lauren, comes in.
Yep.
She's an adult now, and she's taken back her mom's name, and she's saying, what happened to my mother?
Mm-hmm.
She did not die from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Right.
It's obvious. What did she die from? What happened? Because it wasn't this bullshit excuse that this quote-unquote doctor claimed it was.
Right.
So that's why Lauren is a badass, because she's advocating for her mother 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
as she should. And she's working to get answers to find out the truth about what happened to her mother that day.
And she's working tirelessly.
Absolutely.
There is a little bit of an update. So in August of 2020, there was new information that was brought forward. It led to Lori's case being reinvestigated by the East Providence Police Department. The Rhode Island Medical Examiner's Office kind of got involved with it too. The Attorney General's Office and, of course, Unsolved Rhode Island.
For sure.
Which, of course, was started by Lori's daughter, Lauren. The medical examiner's office kind of hinted that Lori Molloy did not die of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm.
They also mentioned that she had no obvious natural or unnatural reasons to die, because there was nothing really remarkable about her body. You know, no gunshot wounds, no evidence of strangulation, no overdose. Thank you. Yes. No overdose. Yeah. Her toxicology report was clean. The senior medical examiner that's handling Lori's new case, he believes that she needed to be exhumed and that her investigation should be redone completely.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, like, let's get on it.
Yeah.
And
there's actually a way you can help with that.
Yes, there is.
You listeners at home,
The latest update, you know, it's still in the works. Detectives are following up on new eyewitness statements and other information that was gathered through an investigation by Unsolved RI.
Nice.
This case, you know, potentially could be presented to the state of Rhode Island for why Lori Molloy's homicide investigation should be officially reopened.
Absolutely.
So if you go onto our website, truecrimeny.com, we have pages for all of our episodes that we do. On the page that's going to be for this case, there's going to be a link to a petition that will get the Attorney General's office to officially reopen and reinvestigate this case.
And she's very close to her goal of signatures.
Yes.
It's on change.org.
Uh-huh.
And like Katie said, it's going to be on our website for you to go in and sign up for, because this case needs to be reopened.
Right. Liz signed it. I signed it. If we could get, you know, the signatures past the goal, that would be great, because clearly these people need some convincing to reopen this case.
Yes, absolutely.
Unsolved Rhode Island is offering a $1,000 reward for anyone with any information leading to any arrest in this case. And anyone with any information is asked to please call the East Providence Police Department at 401-435-7600 or go to unsolvedri.com and email them there.
Yes, and that's the case of the very suspicious death of Lori Molloy.
Yeah.
Thank you again to Lauren, who created Unsolved RI and gave us permission to do this case and gave us all this wonderful, wonderful information.
Mm-hmm.
She is killing it out there. She's doing such a good job.
She's doing great. And Lauren, we hope to collaborate with you in the future, maybe work with some of your other cases that you're doing, and we would love to cover them as well, give them an additional spotlight, because that's what we do here.
That's what we do here at True Crime New England. So, while you guys are on Instagram checking out Unsolved RI's profile, come on over to True Crime NE's profile and we'll give you some updates on other cases as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And you can also email us, of course, truecrimene@gmail.com.
Or, of course, check out our website, truecrimene.com. Please click on our page for this episode and sign the change.org petition.
Please.
You can also go to our handy-dandy submission tool where you can send us cases that you'd like to hear us cover. That would be great.
That would be awesome.
We'd love to hear from you guys.
We'd love to hear from you guys. And again, thank you, Unsolved RI. Go check them out.
Yep, they're doing amazing things.
Great job. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.